American Patriot Insurance Company versus Mutual Risk Management. Mr. Pearson.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Counsel.
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Pearson. I represent plaintiff appellants, American Patriot Insurance Agency, and Diane and Kenneth Hendricks. I've reserved 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Your Honor, the decision of the District Court dismissing plaintiff's case on venue grounds was in error and should be reversed by this Court. All of the defendants in this case waived the defense of proper venue. Secondly, the District Court incorrectly applied the reach of a form selection clause in a single agreement between plaintiff and a non-party to this action to apply to plaintiff's tort claims alleging fraud, RICO, and other torts. As no reading of any controlling Seventh Circuit precedent supports the District Court's unprecedented dismissal of the claims against defendant Cunningham Lindsay, who conceded venue below.
What is it you think Cunningham did that was bad? That was unclear.
Cunningham was responsible for the basic claims administration of the
program. What did it do that was wrong?
Negligently mishandled those claims, negligently reserved those claims, fraudulently, in fact, inflated values of claims, and failed to properly adjust them as an insurance company typically would. They acted as a third-party administrator as a substitute for a claims department within an insurance company. And Legion divested that claims administration authority to Cunningham Lindsay, and they blew it, and blew it badly. The first point I'd like to address, Your Honor, is waiver of the privilege to assert venue. As a matter of controlling Seventh Circuit precedent, the review of that is de novo.
Why do you think there's such a strict rule about venue?
Because it's absolutely consistent with the principles and spirit behind Rule 12.
No. I mean, what's the reason? What's the practical reason?
The practical reason with respect to the substance of venue, Your Honor, or when it needs to be invoked?
Why is there such a strict rule of waiver? Why?
Well, I think as this court in Sharp and in Freach pointed out.
This court. What's your answer? What is the reason?
For purposes of judicial economy, so we can get to the point of where we're going to be fighting the fight at the earliest possible time.
Well, I would have thought it was different. You want to have a situation, one court gets involved in the case, and then, you know, months later, after it's made rulings and so on, it's sent it off to another court. That's obviously wasteful. But that didn't happen here, did it? I mean, the district court hadn't really done anything before venue was challenged.
Actually, it did happen here, Your Honor.
It happened
in the context of the...
Well, what did the district court do? It didn't make any rulings, did it? I mean, it just convened a settlement conference.
It's over a nine-month period.
I know, but what did the court do? It just convened a settlement conference, and that was its only involvement.
No, it also requested a Rule 16 statement.
Did it make any rulings?
No, it did not make any rulings, and I will concede.
Okay, so you had a settlement discussion here rather than Bermuda. So what? I mean,
this court again made clear that sitting on.
Give me what this court said. Give me a reason why, you know, it would be a real problem for the judiciary to have this thing shunted off, sent off to Bermuda after some months of settlement negotiations.
Because it runs absolutely contrary to the spirit and the principle behind Rule 12.
Those are words. Those are not practical concerns.
They are very practical, Your Honor.
Okay, what are the practical concerns?
Because if, in fact, we had known at the earliest possible time that they were intending to invoke a venue provision, a form selection clause, we, of course, would not have agreed to extensions of time in this case. We would have opposed those extensions, and we would have instructed the district court, if we're going to be fighting this case somewhere else, then on the very first request for an extension of time, which was 30 days into the case, we would have opposed it, and there would have been
a... You wouldn't have wanted to discuss settlement with them?
We can discuss settlement here or in Bermuda. That has nothing whatsoever to do with where the case is ultimately decided on the merits. But the burden isn't upon us, Your Honor.
But why would you have changed your behavior if you'd known the case was going to Bermuda? Wouldn't you still have wanted to discuss settlement?
Whether it goes to Bermuda or whether it stays here implicates issues of what law controls here and what law is going to instruct those settlement discussions, the major issue to be considered in connection with the settlement. Remember, this is a non-party.
The person is puzzled by that.
Yeah, right, doesn't it?
Venue and choice of law are distinct questions. This contract has both. Bermuda choice of law and Bermuda choice of forum, one would think even if it were litigated here, it would be litigated under Bermuda law.
Not so, Your Honor, and I think that because the district court made a fundamental error in presuming that the contract containing the, both the venue and the choice of law provision was as between parties to this case. And
that's a different point. That's unrelated to your waiver argument.
I agree with that. I'm following up on the question Your Honor raised with respect to choice of law. The parties to this case aren't governed by that form selection clause or choice of law provision.
Right, as I say, that's unrelated to your waiver argument.
It is, but I was trying to respond to Judge Posner's argument or request as to what would have been different here. And again, we would have early on, in response to a timely assertion by them of this defense, would have opposed any request for extension, and we would have litigated this issue in the district court. And furthermore, they, for tactical reasons, which the district court found, they gamed the system here. Judge Castillo found that they were less than candid with the district court. They gamed the system so that they could go about some scheme of arrangement.
But you knew about the scheme of arrangement.
We did, and worked very hard to extricate ourselves.
So what was the deception? I mean, how are you?
Judge Castillo.
What was the scheme? I know you said that, but I don't understand. If you knew what was going on, what the situation was, what were they accomplishing by this?
Judge Castillo concluded that there were less than
candid
with the court.
I never said that, but I don't understand it. If you, candid doesn't matter if you know what's going on.
I don't believe he did, Judge, and in fact, the representation.
You didn't know that they had filed a bankruptcy petition in Bermuda?
That they intended to proceed with this litigation in Bermuda in lieu of before the district court.
No, the question is, what harm was caused by the delay? Your answer was, well, we didn't know about the plan of reorganization in Bermuda, to which the next question is, how could you not have known? It was a public judicial proceeding in Bermuda.
Which we fought, that's right, Your Honor.
Exactly, so you did know about it. So there was nothing that happened here that was keeping you in the dark. You were, in fact, well aware of it.
But I don't think at the end of the day that, again, I know Judge Posner said forget about the case law, but the case law says that harm is not, it's not our burden.
I'm going to say forget about the case law, too. The Rule 12H1 is really very clear about the time to make a venue motion. It's with the answer. These people did make a venue defense with the answer. And I would find it quite extraordinary to say that instead of following the rules as written, just make up a completely different set of things yourself. That's what you're asking us to do, not follow the rules as written and make something up. In the name of the rules, in the name of the spirit of the rules.
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. Your Honor, yourself wrote in Sharp versus Jefferson that a 7-month delay under 12H1 is too long. This is a 9-month delay, and in this case, they submitted a statement to the court that failed to raise this as a major legal issue in this case. They did not act.
They did not file an answer, did they?
They did not. They did not.
Well, that's what the rule says. You have to file it with the answer. There's a once we go to the trouble of having rules that define exactly when you make a venue argument, it's awfully hard to see how people can be penalized for not doing it at a different time.
I don't think that the cases have defined exact bright line rules, and this case.
Is there any ambiguity in Rule 12H1 about when you make your venue defense?
The U.S. Supreme Court, as long ago as 1939, has said you must make it timely and you can't act inconsistently.
12H1 defines what it is to be timely. With the answer.
It doesn't, Judge. That is one way to be timely. The other way to be timely is to not just simply sit on your hands and be silent when you're requesting extensions after extensions and misleading the district court as to what your intentions are. Your Honor, with respect to the reach of the forum selection clause, the district court erred in this respect, which is clear under both the Omron and Hugel decisions of this court. This is not a contract case.
No, I don't understand. I mean, this shareholder agreement says, you know, that all these things constitute a single insurance program, a single contract, and the other contracts don't contain forum selection clauses. So it looks as if the forum selection clause in the shareholder agreement is intended for this whole network of, you know, inter-incorporated contracts.
And that agreement, the shareholder agreement, runs between Mutual Holdings, which is not a party to this litigation, and not the parties who are parties to this litigation.
No, but it's the sort of master agreement, which, and it says the other agreements, the one under which you're suing, are, you know, they're to be treated as a whole, as a single program with a form selection.
It does contain that language, and if this were
right.
If this were a contract case, I would agree that this case would be governed by the form selection clause. But it's a tort case. They stole $1 million from us under false pretenses. This is not a case where you're asking to interpret or determine the rights and liabilities of the
party. You can't duck a forum selection clause by characterizing a contract dispute as a tort or saying that the contract gave rise to a tort, a fraud, and so on.
I agree with that. The standard is we can't artfully plead around that. We have
or add parties.
Remember, Your Honor, this is hardly artful pleading. We have two separate district courts that have found, not based on artful pleading, but evidence, that a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction orders shall be issued based on evidence. We can't get a preliminary injunction or temporary restraining order based on artful pleading. That requires evidence and evidence of fraud. And we convinced both the Central District Judge King in Los Angeles and Judge O'Meara in Michigan that there was substantial evidence of fraud, and he froze the underlying letters of credit based on that evidence. And I would ask Your Honors to ask defendants why they made no effort to rebut any of the evidence that supported that, because they can't rebut that evidence. So this is hardly an artful pleading case. If it were an artful pleading case, and a different way of putting it, if we were trying to fraudulently plead around the invocation of the Forum Selection Clause, I would understand Your Honor's point.
I don't think it's a matter of fraudulent pleading around. If you have a Forum Selection Clause, it governs other torts that arise out of the contract.
This tort and this fraud did not arise out of the contract. This tort arose out of an entirely separate transaction based on false facts about an alleged exposure that didn't exist. I see my time is out.
You want to
reserve the remaining?
Okay.
Thank you.
Fine. Thank you. Mr. Pearson. Ms. Dunsky?
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Lisa Dunsky. I represent the defendants that were referred to in the brief as the mutual defendants, which is all the defendants with the exception of Cunningham Lindsay. This appeal involved plaintiffs' attempt to sidestep the Bermuda Forum Selection Clause contained in a contract that they signed four times. It's a very difficult task to avoid the Forum Selection Clause.
Well,
in light of control.
Most of the defendants, maybe all of the defendants, never signed a shareholder agreement. And I understand your argument that the disputes nonetheless concern that agreement, but how can we be sure that the non-signatories will appear in Bermuda and be bound by a decision under Bermuda law, given that they've never signed it?
Several responses to that. Mutual Indemnity of the Bermuda Corporation, it's obviously subject to jurisdiction in Bermuda. The other individual defendants, Mr. Alexander, also is a resident of Bermuda, and as we stated in our brief, Mr. Turner and Mr. Partridge have agreed to be subject to the jurisdiction of the courts in Bermuda.
How have they evidenced this agreement?
It wasn't raised below, so we simply made that representation in our brief in this case.
I mean, one would think a minimum requirement would be a signed undertaking by these people to appear in Bermuda, defend under Bermuda law, and satisfy any judgment entered against them in Bermuda.
That is something that we would do. We've never been asked to do that. We've never disputed or made arguments that any of our parties, anyone that we represent, would not be subject to jurisdiction in Bermuda. In fact, we have already filed a separate suit against the plaintiffs in Bermuda.
This wouldn't be the first time people engaged in whipsaw.
It wouldn't be, but we haven't, you know, tried to do that here.
Yet.
All I can say is if we would be asked to sign something to that effect, we certainly would.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. Now, Mr. Pearson wants me to ask you this question, so I'll answer the question. Why haven't you denied the allegations of fraud that led to the issuance of the preliminary injunction?
Well, the case in the district court never got to the merits.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
The case in the district court here never reached the merits, and that's a merits issue. Have we gotten?
He's referring to the other two cases.
The other two cases we contested based on personal jurisdiction and venue, and both of those cases are on appeal to the Sixth and Ninth Circuits, and our position is that it was error for those courts to reach the merits in those two cases without addressing our personal jurisdiction and venue issues and without giving proper collateral estoppel effect to Judge Castillo's ruling that this dispute belongs in Bermuda and not in the United States.
So you had urged your forum selection clause in both those cases also?
That is correct. And in those cases as well, we also had personal jurisdiction issues. The only defendant in those cases that was sued is Mutual Indemnity. So the parties were slightly different, and we had a personal jurisdiction issue in those cases.
Now, where have these settled, during this interval of some months, where were the settlement negotiations conducted?
The negotiations actually occurred here in Chicago because both plaintiff's counsel and mutual defendant's counsel was here in Chicago.
Doesn't that show, you know, you're happy to be in Chicago?
Well, let me comment on what caused a 9-month delay, and I think to understand that it's crucial to look at the agreed motions. Those were not requests for extensions that we made on our own. Those were agreed motions signed off on by all the parties, and if you examine those, they make crystal clear that it was largely the plaintiff's conduct that caused the delay. They asked, for example, for an extensive audit of Cunningham Lindsay's files. They brought in outside auditors. One of the agreed motions says that they were waiting for a report from their outside auditors. So much of the delay was occasioned by plaintiff's conduct and not by mutual defendant's conduct. And I don't think the law can be that a delay caused by plaintiffs results in the waiver of a defendant's privileged defense, such as venue. And if you look at the express language of Rule 12H, it says that privileged defenses are waived if not made by a motion or included in a response of pleading. We did that. I think the suggestion that we were required to expressly raise that in a joint status report is not supported by the language of Rule 12H1 at all. We did what the rule required us to do. We also did not waive the venue objection to our conduct. As I was just saying, all we did was engage in settlement negotiations. The district court did nothing other than enter orders approving requests for extension. The settlement negotiations actually never even proceeded in front of the magistrate judge. They were scheduled, but did not occur because the breakdown of negotiations between the parties happened before that could occur. And we promptly filed our Rule 12b-3 motion as soon as the negotiations broke down. Now, that's certainly a far cry from the Continental Bank case decided by this court, in which the defendant actively participated in merits litigation for 2.5 years and was found to have waived privileged defenses. We did nothing that constitutes active participation in litigation of the merits in this venue. So I think given the facts at hand and both the letter and the spirit of Rule 12H1, the district court was absolutely correct in concluding that the mutual defendants did not waive their venue objection. Briefly to discuss the scope of the forum selection clause at issue, has very broad language. It applies to any dispute concerning the shareholder agreement. It's not limited to disputes between just these plaintiffs and just mutual holdings. Below, the plaintiffs admitted that the forum selection clause applied to their contract negligence.
Suppose the Illinois insurance regulator concluded that this program and the shareholder agreement violated Illinois law or were invalid for some reason. Is it your position that that would have to be arbitrated in Bermuda?
If
it concerns the shareholder agreement, even though the Illinois insurance regulators never signed the shareholder agreement?
I guess I would have to see the allegations and what it was based on. I
can't imagine that the answer would depend on what the allegation was based on.
No, I think that's correct.
Forum agreements are the result of contract, and I right? I don't see how A and B entering into a contract can oblige C, a non-party, to litigate someplace or arbitrate or do anything. Non-parties just aren't bound by other contracts.
No, I think that's correct, and that's in line with what this court found in the Stone case, which what the plaintiffs rely on. But this case is very different from that. Mutual Indemnity is a third-party beneficiary to the shareholder agreement, and in this case, the plaintiffs are asserting breach of that agreement. If this case were to proceed in the district court here, Mutual Holdings would be a necessary and indispensable party, unlike the Stone case where Bear Stearns had absolutely nothing to do with the dispute and was not a party and couldn't have been joined as a party. So I think this case is slightly different. The plaintiffs conceded that the Forum Selection Clause applies to about at least half of their claims, and now they're just trying to rely on the fraud claims as a way to evade the Forum Selection Clause. But even if you look at the fraud claims, those also involve the shareholder agreement. They're alleging that various parties made misrepresentations to them about their liabilities under the shareholder agreement. So to resolve those fraud claims, you need to interpret the shareholder agreement and also other agreements such as the reinsurance treaty, but they're all integrated as one contract.
Well, what are the stakes in this case?
In terms of the dollars involved,
yeah.
Your Honor? Approximately
$8
million.
$8 million.
Yes. So in summary, the claims against all the mutual defendants are integrally related and should be kept in a single forum in Bermuda per the Forum Selection Clause, as the district court concluded.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Dansky. Ms. Chalstrom? You're Cunningham's lawyer?
That's correct, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. The record on appeal itself supports affirming the dismissal of plaintiff's claims against Cunningham Lindsay. Plaintiff did not, nor can they, state a viable claim for relief for either breach of contract or negligence against Cunningham Lindsay. Plaintiff's allegations and the applicable Legion contract were all before the district court. Plaintiff's breach of contract
claim. But the district court didn't rule on the merits, and I didn't get a clear picture from the briefs of what was involved in the Cunningham part of the case.
Plaintiff asserted two claims against Cunningham Lindsay. They named Cunningham Lindsay Inc. as the defendant. In our answer, we asserted that Cunningham Lindsay Claims Management was the claims administrator who had the contract with Legion. Plaintiff brought a breach of contract claim against Cunningham and a negligence claim arising out of the contract, or what they claim to be the contract that imposes the duty.
And did you have a contract with the plaintiff, with the Patriot Insurance?
No, there's no contract with American Patriot, either by Cunningham Lindsay Inc. or Cunningham Lindsay Claims Management. The only contract is with Legion Insurance Company and Cunningham's Claims Management Inc., a Delaware corporation formerly known as Lindsay Morden Claims Management Inc. And that contract was very specific. It was called a two-party claims servicing agreement, whereby the Cunningham party that was a party to that contract would provide claims handling or claims management services for Legion for this program. The plaintiff's breach of contract claim fails because the contract action cannot be maintained by plaintiffs who were neither parties to nor an intended third-party beneficiary of the Legion contract. An entity is a third-party beneficiary to a contract only if the contracting parties entered into the Legion contract directed that those third parties, i.e. the plaintiffs, were to secure some direct benefit from that contract. Plaintiffs here are not third-party beneficiaries to the contract. The contracting parties conferred no direct and primary benefits to the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs were given no rights or obligations or authority under the Legion contract. The contract is entitled a two-party claim servicing agreement entered into by the Cunningham entity and Legion. And it lays out Cunningham's activities and obligations to Legion and Legion's control over Cunningham. Likewise, plaintiffs failed to and cannot state a negligence claim against Cunningham because they seek to recover for Cunningham's alleged breach of a duty created only by contract and damages arising only from the performance of the Legion contract. Only where there is a duty imposed by law apart from a contract may a plaintiff bring a negligence claim. And only in the alternative, even if the plaintiffs are deemed to be third-party beneficiaries to the Legion contract, the district court's order should be affirmed because dismissal was proper, as the Legion contract contained an arbitration clause, which can be enforced against plaintiffs as third-party beneficiaries. If the panel has no further questions, I will close at this time.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Charles.
Thank you.
Mr. Pearson, how much time does he have? 2 minutes? So maybe you could say something about why is it you think that you're a third-party beneficiary of this claims administration contract?
Because the whole house of cards is premised upon the claims administration as it was represented to us. If an insurance company, Legion or Villanova, doesn't properly handle the claims, negligently handles them, under-reserves them, this whole program was doomed to fail, and we were obviously the intended beneficiary of their TPA.
Now, I don't understand that, because that would be an argument which said whenever you have a contract with someone, you're the third-party beneficiary of all his contracts. I mean, suppose you buy, you have a contract to buy something from somebody, from Judge Easterbrook, and Judge Easterbrook, in order to be able to satisfy the contract, he makes a contract with someone else to supply him with the raw material to manufacture the product. And that other person is negligent, fraudulent, what have you. As a result, Judge Easterbrook breaks his contract with you because he hasn't been able. Now, would you argue that you were the third-party beneficiary of the contract between his supplier and him?
If the whole program was represented to me to be an integrated program and premised upon that, yes.
What do you mean by represented to be an integrated program? Were there assurances made to you about Cunningham being, you know, a great company and honest and all that?
They were absolutely implicit in those representations.
What do you mean implicit?
Well, that was what MRM and the Commonwealth Risk Management brought to the table.
Well, Judge Easterbrook said, you know, I'm going to manufacture stuffed animals for you, and they're going to be great
bean bags
because I'm getting my my beans from this, you know, highly reputable manufacturer. So you're really fortunate to have, you know, to have this program. Would that make you a third-party beneficiary of the supply contract? It's very common for someone, if in contract negotiations, you know, the supplier may give assurance, not formal assurance, but explain, you know, it's a reputable operation. I have contracts with X and Y and Z, so I really can deliver. If those guys break their contracts, though, the purchaser doesn't go against
that. Again, under those circumstances, I understand your point, but that's not the circumstances of this case. And had this been raised before Judge Castillo, this would have all been aired out in the context of a proper Rule 12 motion that was never filed. And we would have presented there all of the underlying documents that set forth the representations that were made to us. So I respectfully, what you described is not this case, and there's no record upon which for this court to rely to suggest that's this case, because the district court was never given that opportunity. And all inferences, had it been given that opportunity, would have been construed in our favor.
So you say you have documentary evidence that would support your claim to be third-party beneficiary?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You can have a minute, sir.
Thank you very much. I just want to reemphasize, Your Honor, the parties before this court are not parties to the shareholder agreement. No case has ever extended, applying the closely related doctrine or any other doctrine, has doubly extended the protection of form selection clause. Even one containing a broad arising out of phrase, which this one does not, this one uses concerning clause, not arising out of, so it's a much stricter standard, to the facts of this case. And I want to correct counsel, the form selection clause was never raised before the Michigan court or the California court in connection with the TROs or the preliminary injunctions. They have raised, like in the joint status report, issues concerning personal jurisdiction, but have never raised, and it wasn't until very late in the game, in this case, 10 months into the game, that they raised venue for the first time. And again, we would not have approved these extensions, so it's hypocritical to suggest that we participate.
Well, she says you wanted this audit.
Well, of course we do. And if we can get free discovery, we'll take it under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 1 to get to the just, expedient resolution of a case. But that doesn't mean we have to lawyer the case for them and tell them when to put on their defenses. If this were a law school exam, they would have gotten an F in civil procedure as to when to invoke this defense.
Somebody here would have gotten an F, but we don't have to decide who that is.
And hopefully that will be in our favor, and respectfully we request that Your Honors reverse the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pearson, and thank you, Ms. Johnson.